Hello, John.
Hi, George.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's very toasty here. So I am, I hope this isn't too much information, but I'm actually in my underwear right now.
Well, I guess we can't see that on camera anyway,
no.
So I bet a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
They just don't own up to it.
You know, all those talk show hosts never were wearing any pants.
Oh, yeah. Nah, yeah. Well, Colbert was. I can testify to that.
Oh, he was. Okay.
He was wearing a suit. But it's only 68 degrees Fahrenheit here.
Wow. Well,
it's pretty nice. Of course, it's also only 10:30 in the morning, mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, we're getting... It's hot and muggy. I've got my air conditioning on, but it's, even cranked up full volume. It's barely keeping up with the heat pouring in from the outside, so...
Well, did you see it's been getting up into the triple digits in Seattle and Portland, Oregon?
Oh, my God.
Apparently 107 in Portland.
Wow, that's got to be unprecedented. Right?
Yeah, that's like Phoenix-type temperatures, or at least Tucson.
Oh, that's freaky.
Yeah.
Yeah, because overall it's been very mild here, so...
Yeah, here too. We really haven't broken 100 yet. And I don't think we will. We usually don't, actually. But we got into the mid... I think maybe even the mid-90s, maybe high 90s. I don't know.
We haven't broken 90 yet this summer. Maybe today, but it's been, hasn't even really gotten up to mid-80s. It's been very mild.
Not bad. So have you been staying out of trouble?
Well, I don't know. I've been trying to avoid the God scandal on Blogging Heads TV, but
they had a not just a creationist, but a young Earth creationist, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to say too much because I have to admit that I haven't watched that particular dialogue. I meant to do that before we talked today, and then just didn't get to it. But did you watch it?
I did not. I mean, I just really have no interest in what somebody like that has to say. But, so the issue came up, should Blogging Heads even give a platform to that kind of person, not to certainly promote those views, but to confront them, since there are quite a few people who hold the same view, that the Earth was not created 4 billion plus years ago, and life... didn't emerge, say, 4 billion years, 3.5 billion years
right.
ago.
And it's like 8,000,
yeah,
right?
But
the Bishop Usher interpretation of the biblical generations. Yeah, and Sean Carroll, the UCLA physicist, who's a Blogging Head semi-regular, I guess he was particularly upset, and he sent an email to all of us, and including Robert Wright, and then Carl Zimmer was really, really, really mad about that, too, And I guess I always find myself divided on this. On one hand, I can kind of see the point that you've argued here before, the so-called teach the controversy, that these people are out there, and then maybe you can engage them, and then you'll show the general public how science really works, and that young Earth creationism or intelligent design doesn't really qualify as scientific theories, but they're really ideologies, and get into the difference between a science and a religion, and science as a process rather than a set of dogmas, and all of the subtleties and complications, like is a belief in causality and materialism a dogma.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think the other argument is that, where do you draw the line? I mean, if you're going to bring on young Earth creationists, why not bring on Holocaust revisionists and flat Earth people and all the kinds of people that are on the Art Bell show. And
it's a
UFO cults. And
it's a really difficult question. I guess on this, I think the genesis of this particular conversation was somewhat complicated, but my attitude is, let's confront this. And I pointed out that the New York Times very recently, within the last few weeks, had an article about a bunch of paleontologists in Cincinnati who I think were there for a conference, who decided to go visit a creationist museum there. And so both the paleontologists decided to confront this point of view, and the New York Times decided to. So what's wrong with Blogging Heads doing it? On the other hand, I think the impression that people might have lately is that Blogging Heads has become a God chat program. We certainly have talked about it, talked about religion on this program quite a bit. That particular chat.
Well, because of Bob's book, though, right?
That's right. Also Bob's book,
yeah,
but also because
Evolution of God.
You know, you and I were both part of that Templeton Fellowship, and we're both interested in the difference or possible common ground between science and religion. I think probably the biggest problem is just for me. I think it was a kind of timing thing. I think some Blogging Heads people could, rightly or wrongly, see all these different programs on Blogging Heads as interconnected. The talk about Bob's book, Templeton-funded program, Percontations, or whatever the hell that is.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
Yeah.
So,
like it's all connected.
Yes. God.
You know, there are no accidents.
You know, this reminded me of... So I went through a period when I was sort of into Kundalini yoga about 30 years ago, and I actually took an all-day workshop from this guy named Yogi Bhajan. And yeah, I think he's based in New Mexico now.
I think so. That's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, he's got a community out there.
Oh, in Espanola.
Yes, I think that's right.
He's a Sikh. Is that the one?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, he's also very politically powerful here in the Democratic Party.
Well, I've heard he's a real...
He's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
He's a real player, and he's a classic, you know, guru who says, I'm enlightened, and if you hang out with me and listen to what I say and do what I tell you to do, maybe, just possibly, you can become just a fraction as enlightened as I am.
Wow,
and,
that's
so this,
pretty enlightened.
This is in New York City. I went to this workshop with maybe, I don't know, couple hundred other people. We sat in this big room and he was telling us all this shit to do. And one of the exercises involved pairing off with another person, and you hold that person's hands. You sit right next to each other, facing each other, cross-legged. You hold each other's hands. You stare into each other's eyes and you say God over and over again. God. God, God. So I was in this room.
I'm trying to imagine.
Oh, my God. It was like, so you could imagine all, like a couple hundred people all chanting God at the same time. And maybe it was just my impression, but it seemed to get louder and louder and more intense and kind of frenzied as it continued. And I was looking into the eyes of this perfect stranger, this woman across from me, and I felt like I was looking into... She just looked psychotic. I probably did, too. And the whole thing was just... You know, it was supposed to be... We were supposed to be immersed in the divine or, I don't know, something like that. But to me, it was like being immersed in the... I don't know, the insanity at the heart of the human psyche. It was really scary. And for some reason, all this God shit that, you know, has been on Blogging Heads TV lately just reminded me of that...
Yeah, were you doing that? You were actually doing this seeking enlightenment, and not just so you could write about it and mock it later.
I was seeking enlightenment, George. I've traveled many paths on this twisted life of mine.
Yeah.
And wow. I didn't find it, and I decided that it didn't exist, and people who are selling it are either deluded or frauds.
Yeah. If you have it, it's free.
That's right.
Yeah, well, the Sikhs, and I if this is the same person, the Sikhs are, in addition to being politically powerful in New Mexico, they run, they have really cornered the security industry.
Really?
There's this thing called ACAL, A-K-A-L, Security, in Santa Fe and Espanola, and they, you know, they provide security guards and you know, for shopping centers and for private businesses, and then apparently they got some really big big homeland security government contracts and things.
Really? Do they wear turbans?
Yeah.
So the security guards at these malls are...
Some of them do, yeah.
That's
yeah, but they also, I mean, it's become so big that although they own the business, they hire non-Sikhs as well, so...
Yeah. That's really interesting. Well, you know, there's one thing about these cults or religions of any kind that, you know, if they all band together and become a kind of unified economic force, I mean, the Mormons have shown this, they can really become quite powerful.
Yeah, politically. Yeah.
So here we are
speaking
talking about
of which,
God again.
That sounds like a perfect transition to an article this morning in the New York Times. And I should say that we're recording this on Thursday. So Thursday morning in the New York Times about this, I guess you wouldn't call it a cult, but a group of doctors at a, a group of doctors at a physician-owned hospital mm-hmm. who have contributed this huge amount of money to senatorial campaigns during the healthcare debate. And the reason it really struck me was because it was McAllen, Texas. And, you know, in McAllen, Texas was featured in this wonderful piece that Atul Gawande wrote in the New Yorker, you know, I think it was back in June, where he was comparing healthcare costs in McAllen, Texas and El Paso and finding McAllen is off the map. I guess it's like the... It's according to some surveys, it's the highest cost healthcare in the United States, right?
Yeah, I think it's right at the top. I jotted some things. I thought, you know, we've been wanting to talk about that article in the New Yorker for a while now. I think it came out like June 1st or something.
And yeah, it's
I thought
ago.
It was brilliant. I thought it was the single best thing I've read on the whole healthcare debate, health insurance
yeah.
debate. Ever.
Amazing,
really?
Amazing piece of journalism.
Because it was so...
I mean, so this guy who's a doctor, Gawande, goes to McAllen, Texas, and he confronts all these people and says, well, why is it that it costs more to get, you know, every procedure, healthcare, just in general, that it costs more for healthcare in McAllen, Texas than anywhere else in the country and presumably the world?
$16,000.
Most of the United States.
Well, so I guess one of the best measures of... healthcare cost per capita is Medicare because it's tracked so closely because it's a
yeah.
federal program. So $16,000 per enrollee, Medicare enrollee, that's up from $4,800 in 1992. That was about the national average. So it was more or less average in 1992. By 2008, by the present, it had become... I think slightly more than twice as high as the national average, or maybe even
right,
three times.
Right.
And which is just incredible. So, you know, what I liked about the article was that there wasn't the usual grandstanding that you get in these debates over healthcare. It was very data driven. So,
yeah.
You know, this Dr. Gawande goes out and tries to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the first things, the most important thing, I think, for people to know out there, and, you know, this is the kind of thing I'm constantly getting in arguments over national health insurance with friends of mine, particularly libertarian, fascist-type friends who think it's all a big socialist plot. But what
yeah,
this article
right.
tells them, this is really what they need to know. There is an inverse correlation in this country between the amount of money spent on patient care and the actual care they get, the outcomes mm. for people's health.
Right.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And horrible.
Yeah. And this McAllen case was so interesting because it seems like a very unlikely locale for, you know, being the most expensive. It's near the border with Mexico. It's a very poor farming region, although I guess there is also a great deal of wealth there, presumably from, you know, cattle and oil and I don't know what else. So there's large disparities in income. And when Gawande goes around and talks to all these various doctors, including the manager of the local, I guess, the public hospital, and then this doctor-owned hospital, I mean, everyone professes to have had no idea that McAllen was off the chart and that they'd never heard this before. And then they start speculating and the different theories, and of course a lot of the doctors at the doctor-owned hospitals say, no doubt this is because, you know, citizens of McAllen are getting the best health care in the country.
Yep.
But as you say, the statistics don't really bear that out. And then he goes down to El Paso, Texas, which was a great place to compare, I think, because it's also right on the border with Mexico, and it has, mm-hmm. you know, lots of very poor people, and... presumably also this, you know, there's a lot of the oil and gas industry is headquartered in El Paso. So you have the same disparities of income. And there you don't find, you know, I don't know if they were near the bottom, but they were much more average as far as health care costs.
Yeah. I think, and then he he goes to another villain blamed by the doctors for the high health care costs were lawyers for filing malpractice suits, but in fact...
Oh, right, but Texas had this cap.
Right. So Texas actually has among the lowest malpractice awards, or even the threat, one of the lowest threats of malpractice awards. So that wasn't a factor at all. That was ruled out.
Yes, you just keep reading this. I love, too, how he didn't write this like in the classic magazine article style where you'd have your lead and then you'd have your nut graph saying, you know, what the significance of the story is and what he found. So you just kind of muddle through this mystery, you know, with the writer, and you're going, well, yeah, wait, why is this? Because
right.
every theory that's put forth has kind of exploded, and then in the end, you really kind of come out with this very subtle explanation.
Yeah, which is that the doctors in this area are very aggressive, and they're very entrepreneurial, and they see medicine basically as a profit-generating enterprise.
Yeah, it's just cash flow, so they can invest in shopping centers and,
right,
you know, in Kentucky Fried Chicken chains and things. So, and what interested me, and then, you know, so why McAllen? But I guess what I took away from the article was that there are really two kinds of doctors, or maybe two kinds of human beings, you know, in this, if you slice it this way. And first, you have doctors who really get into it because, you know, they're really interested in medicine. I mean, some of them get into it for altruistic purposes. Some of them, you know, for the intellectual challenge of diagnosis. Some want to do good. Some just want to have an interesting, you know, well-paying job. And even a, you know, physician working on salary and not as a private entrepreneur is going to have, you know, a comfortable salary and be able to, you know, lead a good middle-class life.
Right.
And then you have people whose primary interest is making money, and they just happen to become doctors or dentists.
Right.
And then they get this cash flow, and then they're just wanting to maximize profits. And then for various random reasons and historical contingencies, you get clusters of these in certain places like McAllen, Texas.
Mm.
And kind of the opposite seemed to be Grand Junction, Colorado, where doctors formed this cooperative, were not exactly a cooperative, but they would get together and share information and discuss cases, and there was the sense of them all being in it together and watching each other, and they as a result had some of the lowest health care costs.
Yeah, I thought there was, so another contrast was with Rochester, Minnesota, which is dominated by the Mayo Clinic, and there the doctors all agree to pool profits, and they draw a straight salary. So they have no incentive for prescribing extra tests or medical procedures, surgery, longer hospital stays, those sorts of things, which are grossly overprescribed in McAllen because they generate more profits. And you know, so the doctors give up some autonomy in the Mayo Clinic model. But as a result, the costs are almost a third of what they are per patient in McAllen, and the health care is better. The outcomes for the patient, I mean, it's just extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
You know, less.
And you can't say these poor doctors at Mayo Clinic on salary that they're not making a good living.
Right.
And they live in nice houses, and they have nice cars, and there's only so much money you really need to make.
Ooh. George, that's kind of un-American. You know, one of the interesting things...
Oh, yeah, I know it is. See, I use my father as an example because he was a doctor.
Ah.
I think I've mentioned this before. And he was a doctor, an Army doctor in World War II.
Uh-huh.
And he was about the most non-entrepreneurial person you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
After he mustered out of World War II and came back from Germany, he joined the Veterans Administration.
Right.
He just wanted to be a doctor. He didn't want to set up an office and, you know, buy equipment and hire staff or join a practice. So he stayed with the VA all his life, you know, and he raised a family, you know, six of us. We had a, you know, nice middle-class existence in Albuquerque, New Mexico. But I specifically remember there was one time he came home from work and he was saying how some of the other doctors were asking if he wanted to get in on buying some vacant property up in the Northeast Heights of Albuquerque. And he decided, nah, you know, I don't want to get into that. And then You know, it's never going to go anywhere anyway. It's just a bunch of tumbleweeds out in the middle of nowhere. And now this is kind of the, you know, the population epicenter of the city. So it would have made a scad of money. That
oh, you could have been sitting on a trust fund worth millions, George.
I know.
If your father had just gotten on board the great ship capitalism.
Yeah. You know what he did instead?
What?
He bought United States savings bonds.
Oh, God. It just sounds like, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or one of these old
but
Gary
hey,
Cooper
still,
movies.
We still have these two savings bonds, and they're paying 4.5% interest right
oh,
now.
Oh, wow. That's a lot, actually. That's not bad.
Yeah. So, anyway, there's two types of doctors.
Good ones and bad ones.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure there's good and bad on both sides. But and it's interesting about Mayo. You know, there was another good piece in the Times that was in the Week in Review on Sunday that I put it over here in my other screen, if I can find it. Let's see. No, that's the New Yorker piece. Here we go. The headline was, "Forget who pays medical bills, it's who sets the cost."
Yeah.
It was one of these nice economic pieces by David Leonhardt. And he was mentioning this case where during the Depression, a doctor in western Oklahoma came up with this idea to form a kind of medical cooperative for farmers. You know, we're right here at the beginning of the Depression, and mm-hmm. It says rather than pay piecemeal for treatments, the farmers would contribute $50 a year to this cooperative, and then his colleagues would pay their own salaries and expenses, and that, you know, then they would just treat them and, you know, make a living at it, and the farmers would, you know, have reliable health care. And apparently it was groups like this and the threat of these co-ops was a big instigation to the American Medical Association.
Yeah.
Banding together to try to beat this back. Mm-hmm. Because it was just, you know, there's no way, you know, doctors, you know, we have to you know, charge for each procedure. We have to decide, you know, what we get paid for this. And, you know, that's been the story ever since. And some of the suggestions that have come forth for combating medical inflation have been, you know, say reimbursing just for treating a certain illness or a condition instead of test by test. So if somebody comes in and has the flu or breast cancer or a broken leg, that there would just be kind of an agreed upon shop manual as far as what it takes to treat that and the average cost, and if everyone was getting the average cost, the doctors, you'd win some, you'd lose some, but you wouldn't have this incentive to order more tests.
Of course,
on the other hand, you might have the incentive to order less tests, and maybe some of these tests would be necessary, and then I
think, yeah. One of the implications of this Gawande article, that is, so you have in the Mayo Clinic, you've got the head of it. His number one priority is patient care, and that can be measured. You know, statistically you can look to see what the outcomes for people are for various kinds of surgery or drug treatments or whatever, and then you're also watching cost, but that's not the number one priority. But what the article said was that when you just look at patient care and you also encourage information sharing among doctors and so forth, then the costs just naturally fall.
Yeah.
Which again is kind of amazing. Maybe that is too simplistic, but that's what they said had happened in the case of the Mayo Clinic. But one of the, you know, what was sort of disturbing about the article was right at the end. You know, I thought it had laid out the issue so clearly that, you know, there's a lot of fat, a lot of waste in the system, and far from being just superfluous, it's actually harming people because, of course, tests and medical procedures and so forth have risks, and so more of them sometimes actually makes patients worse off. But at the very end, Gawande says that in Grand Junction and some of these other places where El Paso, where doctors had been more driven by patient care and less by profits, now because of the economic downturn, they are starting to they're getting more worried about money. And so, if anything, there's sort of this push more toward the McGowan model. Mm. And at the very end, it says the decision in the debate over health care is whether we are going to reward the leaders who are trying to build a new generation of Mayos and Grand Junctions. If we don't, McGowan won't be an outlier. It will be our future.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's human nature. I mean, let's say you're a doctor and you're one of the Grand Junction type doctors, and then, you know, you look over your shoulder and you see someone who's no better trained than you, no smarter, no better a doctor, and they're making, you know, 10 times as much money as you are. It would be...
It's hard.
It'd be difficult. And I don't know. I mean, part of this other article that was in the Times today, Thursday, about the fact that McGowan is also in this doctor-owned hospital is also the source of, you know, this huge amount of senatorial campaign contributions.
Right.
You know, and what they're hoping is to avoid any kind of restrictions on physician-owned hospitals. But it just seems perfectly reasonable to me that they shouldn't even be allowed to exist.
And that this is the vision of medicine that's so celebrated by Fox Republicans,
right?
Entrepreneurial capitalist medicine, which is giving us worse care at higher cost. How does that make any possible sense?
Yeah, and we've all been to doctors like that, and you really do see two kinds. There's some you go into the practice, and the waiting room will just be packed with people. You know, they're double booking, and you know, just. Getting the cash stream coming in there, you wait and you wait and you wait, and the idea is just kind of like, well, you know, you're the patient, you know, you're going to wait to see the great doctor, and we're going to get as much throughput as we can today so we can, you know, maximize profits. I mean, the other side of it is that in many places there are a shortage of doctors with certain specialties, so they get more demand than they can, you know, really take care of, and they feel obligated to, you know, take this many patients. So it's not black and white. But then we've also, most of us, I think, gone to the other kind of doctor, you know, where you go in and they spend a lot of time with you, and, you know, they're not overbooked, and, you know, they're just really kind of content making, you know, a measly $150,000 a year or something with their smaller practice.
Mm-hmm. What I try to do is just stay away from those damn doctors entirely. So far, it's working.
Yeah. So no, that's good. So yeah, that's right. You don't even get like annual checkups, right?
Nah.
Yeah.
It's a waste.
Well, you seem to be doing okay with that.
Well, I also know that Tess, that George, as we've discussed, and as is confirmed by the facts, that tests don't do you any good. So.
Yeah. Well, some of them do.
Anyway, okay.
We've hashed that out.
Yeah. I'm glad we got to that article, though, finally, because that's really been, you know, that's been an oversight on our part. Okay, so what do we got?
It's great seeing journalism like that. Yeah, what else were we going to get into?
Okay, a couple of things just briefly that I've been involved in personally. Chris Mooney, the science journalist and occasional Blogging Heads correspondent, was just in town last week at the Hastings Center, a bioethics think tank here, to give a talk about his new book, which is called Unscientific America. Mm-hmm. And I guess Chris was talking about this with Carl Zimmer recently, and the thesis is that Americans are really just ignorant dumbasses and just know nothing about science. You know, so some of those really depressing poll data that show that most people don't know why we have seasons, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, dinosaurs and humans existing. I don't remember if that was part of it. The one that always sticks in my mind is that people don't even know where seasons come from. And
it seems like every year there's like an Associated Press story like this. You know, there's been some survey and...
Yeah, and so Chris is worried about... He said, you know, people just don't care about science. They're ignorant about science. Scientists are depicted as creeps or emotionless robots or mad scientists who are going to destroy the world. or as religion-hating atheists in the case of somebody like Richard Dawkins. And Chris was suggesting that somehow scientists have to upgrade their image in the public mind. Science journalists used to help, but at least some science journalists used to help promote the image of scientists, but science journalists are now a vanishing breed, Chris said. So scientists have an even greater responsibility to try to communicate with the public and tell the public about how important science is and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
not hard to argue with any of that.
Oh, no, it's not hard to argue with that. So I pointed out afterwards, well, Chris, what about scientists who are just trying to foist bullshit on people, sometimes with really serious consequences for people's well-being? So the one that, of course, I've harped on is psychopharmaceutical research, psychiatric drugs, which psychiatrists who are, many of whom are in the pocket of drug companies, are trying to tell us will cure whatever ails us. I think there's a lot of pseudoscience that comes in the name of evolutionary psychology and behavioral genetics. I think a lot of physics is bullshit, as you know. So
yeah, all your usual.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, not seriously. I think, you know, to say that I think scientists, what I pointed out to Chris, Chris and I have argued about this before, I think scientists do all too good a job about promoting their own theories. And we still need those journalists who are now definitely are very much an endangered species to point out some of the problems with the science.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So
he probably agrees with that, though.
Yeah, he did, but that wasn't his, you know, that wasn't
that's
the
just not his theme, though, yeah.
It's not his theme.
Well, yeah, so what do you think, I mean, I'm... How do you confront scientific ignorance? I mean, the people who don't believe in the germ theory of disease or believe that the Earth is at the center of the universe and things like this, they're not going to read science journalism anyway.
That's right.
So.
I'm not really, you know, I get really uncomfortable with this whole idea of scientists or science journalists educating the benighted masses. It's so condescending and paternalistic. I think in a, you know, market-based economy like ours, you just try to, you know, look, the New Yorker, there's some publications that are still doing an extraordinary job at covering complex
issues. Yeah, and you can't make
issues.
People read this stuff. So.
No, but, you know.
Yeah, it's the schools, right?
Yeah, the schools.
Blame it on the schools.
Hey, I think I've mentioned before that the smartest student I've had, certainly one of the smartest I've had, was a young Earth creationist.
And
was just brilliant at parrying every argument I had.
Well, you've got to be a really good debater to be able to defend something, you know, so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, you can be very skilled, or, you know, very high in rhetorical skills and, you know, rapid information processing.
Yeah. Well, so Chris and I, we thought maybe we should get on to hash this out. He made his comment that he thinks that creationists and the new atheists, you know, Dawkins, Sam Harris, those folks, are mirror images of each other, and which I completely disagree with. I think you can accuse Dawkins and Harris and Hitchens of being rude, but the creationists are saying things that are just flat out wrong.
I think we need people like this.
Yeah.
You know, the more forceful, the better.
Right.
Yeah, there really has been a backlash that now, you know, even among fairly moderate people about the so-called new atheists. And, you know, I heard a lot of that when I was at this Templeton thing in Cambridge, you know, during the, I guess that was May when I was out there, April and May.
Yeah.
You know, the real backlash because they... You know, because they're bullies.
They're rude,
intellectual bullies. But then again, they're just so frustrated because you get these people and then their whole counter to your argument is, well, you know, because that's what I believe. And
right.
Period.
And when it comes to young Earth creationism, it's, you know, it's just, there's there's just huge mountains of data that contradict that view, and there's nothing analogous to that on the side of the atheists or agnostics or whatever who are criticizing religion. So they are
not real sophisticated young earth creationists, and I don't know, this probably applies to the guy who was on, I don't know, but they'll really get into interesting matters of philosophy of science, or they'll kind of lapse into this postmodern thing where all knowledge is basically constructed. And
what a bunch of bullshit.
I mean, you can take any theory. You can take the theory that any theory, if you examine it really closely, you can find little gaps and things that aren't explained.
If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Right. So if you're arguing like a lawyer, you can marshal, I guess this is what I meant to say, you can marshal evidence for any case at all. You can just take a position, and that's what really good debaters learn, in debating teams and school, when they go to college, and they can basically be given any position at random, and they can argue for it.
Yep.
And they can amass data, and you can do this for your young earth creationism, or you can use it for the theory that disease isn't caused by germs, but it's caused by strange rays coming from the direction of the Andromeda galaxy. You can do this, but it's not science.
Right.
It's, you don't set up that. I guess I'm just sort of repeating what this guy said in that article I did a few weeks ago in the Times about the archaeologist that has this idea that, about the Chaco Meridian. We talked about that last time,
yeah,
so I won't repeat it, but just, just how do you do science?
Yeah. Well,
are you only doing science if you're doing this Popperian null hypothesis that you then try to refute? But anyway, that you can do this stuff to kind of muddle up the picture, and then so a lot of the people who are supporting young earth creationism happen to be better debaters than the people supporting the theory of evolution.
And, yeah.
And then they end up, just vastly misleading the audience.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that you get powerful people like Dawkins who can just come out there and just slice these people to ribbons.
Yeah, except that if you really are worried just about changing the minds that need to be changed, I guess you have to say he's bringing about a kind of political shift, let's say. He's not having a positive impact. I don't know if that can be quantified, but it certainly seems that a lot of moderate secularists try to distance themselves from those guys.
Yeah, but also having a lot of people come forward and just said, God, it's about time. I've been just, I'm always afraid to say I'm an atheist because, it's just, just looked down upon, and then, I sit here and listen to my friends with their smug religious beliefs, and I'm afraid to confront them because it's not polite to confront people about what they believe, no matter how unsupported the belief. And so I think a lot of people have kind of come out of the closet because of, the popularity of Sam Harris's book and Dawkins and Hitchens.
It's funny. I think I'm the opposite of you, George. I find myself confronting people in their beliefs no matter what the beliefs are. So postmodern atheists, they annoy me, and I try to poke holes in their smugness, which in some ways I find even more annoying than that of the of religious believers. But certainly then when I get a Christian in front of me, I have to poke that with a stick too.
So you kind of see your role in life is basically just to confront people, and
I love to argue.
Justify what they're... Yeah, you love to argue.
Yeah, I think arguing I see as kind of a sport. And the problem is that some people don't see it as a sport. They take it very seriously. I guess I do too, but some people get upset and take it personally, so...
Yeah.
But then I back off, usually.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got a... Do you want to have a feel-good story to end with?
Yeah.
Well, I think we were going to talk about this last time.
Oh, the whales?
Yeah, this is the Times Magazine article on the whales, which was, thought, it almost seemed like a throwback to, 1960s science.
Yeah, it was by Charles Seibert.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking for it here.
So, the gist...
So, yeah, why don't you summarize the...
Well, there are a bunch of different things in it. So it started off, I thought it was going to be about... You know, it's funny, being a somebody who's written for magazines, sometimes you can look at a piece and see maybe some of the editing process implicit in it. And
yeah.
This looked like... It had started out as one kind of article, and then the editors got a little nervous about that, and then they switched it around. They gave it a much harder lead, and then it became kind of new agey by the end. But the hard lead was about these whale strandings and how now there's pretty good evidence that they are being caused by some of these sonar tests, military... Well, I guess both scientists and the military are using very powerful sound bursts underwater for various purposes. And,
yeah, and of course whales use sound bursts to communicate, so it's just totally messing them up was the idea.
Well, I guess also these would be incredibly loud. Some of these sound bursts, and so it might actually be damaging their ears, and they end up swimming up to the surface so rapidly that apparently they get the bends.
Yeah.
Which is incredible. And so,
yeah.
So they've done autopsies.
Yeah. Whales getting the bends.
Yeah. So they've done autopsies on some of these things, and they found bleeding around their brains and ears, lesions in their livers, lungs, and kidneys, nitrogen bubbles in their organs and tissue, which is what you get when you have the bends.
Right.
And so... I guess.
Yeah, so the story, you're right. The story started out being about this particular environmental problem, and wasn't there a Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, and of course the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going
to
stop the military
from
doing these things.
Yeah, we have to give the military a leeway to do this testing and maneuvers, and, you know, we can't let the...
Right.
Let the health of the whales interfere with that, so...
Yeah, so, you know, they're saying that we can't... We can't second-guess senior Navy officers' specific predictive judgments and forcing them to deploy an inadequately trained anti-submarine force. Oh, fuck those whales. We got submarines out there that still need to attack the Soviet Union. Wait a minute. Soviet Union? Oh, yeah. Well, they got to attack something.
Yeah. Haven't they tried to recruit whales to, like, use them as attack submarines?
Jeez, I don't know. Definitely dolphins.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
of,
dolphins.
But yeah, so if they could get the whales into the military to help with the effort, it could be a win-win situation.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, so the article started off, you know, with this really interesting scene with the beached whales, and then kind of gets into the sonar, you know, scrambling their brains and ruining their lives, and, you know, just very disturbing stuff.
Yeah, but then... It becomes about how there's this group of, I think it's gray whales that have developed this really intense relationship, a very close relationship with humans in, is it the Baja? The Baja Bay or whatever it's called.
Peninsula.
And, and the irony is that these whales were, gray whales. That some of these whales used to be extremely aggressive toward humans, and humans used to be extremely aggressive toward them. They, you know, hunted them almost to extinction. And then I guess there was a ban on hunting going back, I don't even know how far. I'm a little unclear. I'm just skimming this thing as we look. So anyway, the hunting was stopped. And... before the hunting stopped, the whales would sometimes attack boats with humans. They were actually called devil heads or devil...
Yeah.
Oh, hard-headed devil fish, they were called, because of the ferocity with which they would defend themselves and their young, smashing whaling vessels and killing their occupants. Oh, okay, the ban went into effect with most nations in 1937, and the gray whale population has really bounced back.
So, but then the whales decided we were okay, right? And they wanted to be our friends. Was that the...
Yeah.
the message.
So now this is about how these boats go into this harbor, and the whales are swimming around with their young, which is, and you'd expect the females, they have, you know, they're very close to their young, and very protective of them normally, but the whales are allowing these boats of people to come up and rub them on the snout and even rub their babies and swim around with them. And so then, this is where it gets really New Agey. There's this one person interviewed by the author who suggests that the whales are showing that they have a cultural memory of the period of violence and hunting and so forth. But now they're actually trying to show forgiveness toward the humans.
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of what links all of that together. You know, the title was Watching Whales, Watching Us, and this notion that we've been kind of having this long-term relationship with whales and speculating that even though we've done really crummy things to them, you know, like with the sonar, that, you know, they're starting to, you know, maybe forgive us and have, you know, sympathy or empathy and realizing that all humans aren't bad and kind of developing this complex relationship that's as much initiated by them as it is by us, isn't
right.
That kind of the theme?
Yeah, and so there, you know, there's a little extra science thrown in about how spindle cells, which are these really, as that suggests, really hairy, complicated brain cells or neurons, have been found in whale brains, and spindle cells, which have lots and lots of synaptic connections with other cells, are thought to be to play a very strong role in higher cognitive functions in humans, for example, self-awareness, a sense of compassion, and linguistic expression.
Right.
And now it turns out that there are whale experts who have found that, well, obviously we know that whale language is quite complex, but there are whale dialects. So some of the good whale experts can even identify where a whale has come from or what its migration pattern might be based on its particular dialect.
Right, right. So more of this idea, this kind of seems to be a general theme with Charles Seibert, who wrote the article, though, this trying to look at the world from the, you know, perspective of another species. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, he had a piece a couple of years ago, remember, about elephants going crazy?
Uh-huh.
And just all these examples of elephants in Africa, you know, just suddenly going berserk and attacking people, and then talking to environmentalists and environmental scientists and, you know, about speculating on what was driving the elephants crazy, but, you know, basically their interaction with humans and destruction of habitat. And then I noticed at the end of the article it says that he just wrote a book called The Wachula Woods Accord Toward a New Understanding of Animals. And I haven't seen the book yet, but I did some Googling, and Wachula turns out to be this retirement home for chimpanzees in Florida, where, you know, they send, you know, after they've led a good life in the entertainment industry as comedians, and, you know, I'm not sure if it also includes chimpanzees who've been used in experiments, but there are certainly places like that, and apparently there's this encounter that Seibert has with one of the chimps where he just feels this real empathy and, you know, sitting there staring into each other's eyes, kind of like with your experience maybe with the Yogi Bhagwan.
Sounds much better than my experience, actually.
it does sound better, yeah. So I wonder, it'd be interesting, I don't know if the book is entirely about human-chimpanzee interactions or if he also incorporates some of the other stuff he's done on elephants and whales.
Well, this whole issue, so there's another scene, and there, you know, I think what I like best about this article is some of it is a little squishy, but some of the stories really are fascinating. So there's a story about, I'm just reading here, and, you know, some of these stories come from Mexicans who are fishing in this area where there are a lot of whales. So this guy was fishing and he's actually kayaking off Cabo San Lucas, and he sees some gray whales that are attacked by pilot whales. I think pilot whales are sort of like small orcas. They've got teeth, and so they are they're carnivores. And out of nowhere, a group of humpback whales, who are baleen whales, just like the gray whales, helped the gray whales fend off the pilot whales. So it was almost like, you know, there was some tribal affinity between the humpbacks and the gray whales, and so the humpbacks decided to help the.
Like they had some kind of mutual protection treaty that they'd signed, like NATO or something.
Yeah.
I mean, you just get this picture more and more of this, you know, this undersea culture. It's
that's right.
You know, I mean, with the whale equivalent of politics and.
Yeah.
And that opens up the whole question of whether they could even have a history, you know, in the sense, you know, where you'd have alliances and things that have changed because of, you know, cultural exchange of memes and, I mean, you could really go crazy with this stuff.
Do you remember?
It's fascinating.
This just popped into my head. Do you remember that, that crazy meeting we went to on the limits of scientific knowledge at Santa Fe Institute back in, I don't know, 94 or so? And there there was a German scientist who was really obsessed with fractals there. What's his name? Rossler? Otto Rossler or something like that. And
I'm not remembering.
And I remember he was a really interesting guy. He was kind of out there. And I remember after all his talks, it was kind of everybody be sort of looking at each other out of the side of their eyes. And he gave this one talk about the future, and he was basically saying that whales are clearly more intelligent than us. They've got these gigantic brains, and he was foreseeing some period in the future when humans would finally recognize just how profoundly intelligent whales are, and and we would somehow benefit from that ancient wisdom.
Yeah.
And everybody's looking at him like, what? But, you know, I think this article kind of confirms it.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember that guy.
Yeah. I wrote about him a little bit in The End of Science, in that chapter that I wrote on that conference, The Limits of Knowledge. You know,
let's go back and look at that.
The interesting issue for me, I've got this friend who actually has made a point. She loves these videos of animals from different species who've become buddies. So there's one that has been seen a million times on YouTube about an elephant and a dog that are buddies, and it, you know, so it shows them frolicking around, and then something happened to the dog. The dog got a spinal cord injury, and one smart-ass viewer said, "Yeah, it's probably because the elephant stepped on it," and so the dog was treated for a couple of weeks, and they show the elephant kind of, you know, moping around while the dog is going. And of course, you're anthropomorphizing like crazy when you see these things.
Yeah.
But then the dog comes back, and they show them, you know, the dog's got this big thing around its, wrapped around its midsection, and you know the elephant is like rubbing its trunk on the dog, and there's another one she just sent me with a. It shows a monkey kissing a cat, and the cat is on its back, and the monkey is just—it's like making out with the cat, and it's
very weird.
It's the funniest thing. I actually sent this to a primate expert I know, and she said that that breed of monkey, that species, actually they do that with each other. They like to stick their fingers and tongues inside other monkeys because they're obsessed with the tastes and smells coming out of their, you know, various body orifices.
You think the cat would you know, react fairly badly to that.
Well, that's the thing. She said that puzzling.
The cat and the monkey, that's a pretty even grudge match. I mean,
But, so the question is, how do you explain this in terms of selfish gene theory, this sort of trans species, or, you know, or for that matter, what Susie, my wife, does, you know, she's devoted her life to taking care of birds.
Right.
So, I don't know, maybe it's our reciprocal altruism module that's become hijacked by some particular cultural meme, but that works also in animals, too?
Yeah, like the same little modules and patterns that you would have for, like, child rearing and protecting people in your gene pool. You know, it seems like that could become transferred and mapped on to, you know, other situations.
Yeah.
You know, once you have a, you know, again, it seems like it would have to be, you know, a brain that has enough processing power so that it can kind of abstract beyond the genetic roots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess that's where our great hope lies. It's funny with when you see these videos on YouTube of these two animals. There's also one with a tortoise and an aardvark or something, or, you know, two, I mean, some of them are really, they got the two most different animals that you can possibly imagine, and they just show them romping around and, you know, licking each other and so forth. And, you know, so the comments are all, oh, you know, they're so cute. And but then somebody always says, boy, there's such a lesson here for humans. If aardvarks and painted turtles can get along, why can't the Israelis and Palestinians?
Oh, ouch. I don't know. That kind of stuff just really, yeah. I should.
Oh, George, are you going to be a curmudgeon?
I'm not going to get into it. Yeah.
On the other hand,
this is reminding me of that rather pointed exchange that I had with your wife about birds versus cats a year or so ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Susie's pretty hardcore when it comes to cats.
I just wish the cats would kill the pocket gophers that have been, you know, tunneling through my yard and killing my trees. But you know, where's this cat aggressiveness when you need it? But yeah, so I don't know. You know, the next thing I'm going to do is go chase lightning.
For an article?
Yeah.
Oh man, you're on a good streak. That sounds like fun.
get rid of all this abstract stuff and these philosophical things about trans species communications. I just want to do something really basic and go watch lightning. No, actually, last week I drove down to the Langmuir Laboratory, which is on top of South Baldy Peak in the Magdalena Mountains in southern New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And they have this, you know, big, fully equipped laboratory up there where they can measure electromagnetic fields and X-rays generated by lightning blasts. And, of course, they have cameras and things and underground bunkers. And while I was down there, there was this young woman who had all these rockets set up on the top of South Baldy Peak. And then they were waiting for a storm to approach. You know, they monitor the radar and the electrical potential between the, you know, in the air, between the air and the ground. And then if they it gets to a certain level, they jump into this underground metal bunker, and then they fire these rockets that are hooked up to long spools of wire. And then if you're lucky, you'll induce a lightning bolt.
Induce one.
And the lightning bolt will come down right where you want it, so you know just where it is, and you have all this measuring equipment set up to measure various characteristics. And they almost, just when I arrived there, you know, the storm warning siren started beeping. It's not really a siren, just a beeper. And then everyone is ready to shoot the rockets, but then the storm passed. And then ever since then, it's been bright and clear. So. Haven't seen it yet, but later this, you know, maybe this weekend, it depends on how the weather goes, I'm going to follow around this guy from Colorado who chases lightning storms with a big truck full of high-speed cameras and all kinds of equipment. So.
Wow, that is so cool. Let me just make sure I understand that, the rocket thing. So those go up, and what, they actually, the charge in the upper atmosphere is transmitted down through the cable to the ground, so
so the bolt will actually come down through the cable, and so it's not, it's not like a lightning rod where it's attracting a naturally generated lightning bolt. It's actually inducing the lightning bolt by providing this really easy low resistance path between the cloud and the ground.
Is it just as intense as a natural lightning bolt?
That I don't know. The pictures I've seen make me think maybe not.
Yeah.
But, because, you know, normally with the lightning bolt, first you get, basically you have all this negative charge, you know, that's, you know, miles up in the air. And then this, you know, just from electrostatic repulsion, you have a positive charge on the surface of the Earth, and if the potential gets strong enough, you get a lightning bolt, and it
right.
starts out with what they call a stepped leader, which is where, you know, you can see in slow motion photography how the cloud is like sending down a feeler and trying to find a path to ground, and then once it gets near the ground, a big, you know, bolt will come up from the ground and connect with the leader, and then you get the big upstroke, which is the lightning bolt that we actually see most of the time.
Really? Wow, that's interesting. I never knew it worked. So it's not just from the sky down to the ground, it's from the ground up to the cloud as well.
Yeah, right. It starts, usually, there's a lot of exceptions, but it starts with, you know, this electrical feeler kind of coming down from the cloud, and this creates a charged path. And then you get a return of charge up from the ground. So the wire is just kind of a way of making that happening, you know, when and where you want it, so you can study the lightning. And as long as you're underground in this completely grounded metal bunker, which is what in physics they call a Faraday cage after Michael Faraday, then you're perfectly safe mm-hmm. as long as you don't go outside. But I'm going to go down again when the weather gets worse. And it's really cool. You drive, like, for 10 miles up this windy dirt road to get to the mountaintop, and then there's this big lightning lab up there.
Wow, that, you know, I love the way you find these science stories that are like, so, you know, stuff going bang and with big flashing lights and sparks and shit. I mean,
it's something I've only gotten into recently. I think I just got burned out on theory.
Well, but you know, you've remember when you used to bring those funky old generators and things onto the show
and for GarageBand Science.
Yeah.
I haven't done that for, God, it's been over a year at least.
Yeah, it might be time to revive that just to, I don't know, if you can find an experiment that somehow provides a microcosm of lightning generation or something.
I already did plasma bolts, like with my Ruhmkorff coil and my Wimshurst machine, so I could make more little lightning bolts, but I've already done that, so...
Yeah. That's good,
though,
George.
Blow something up. I know, I was going to do a light bulb in a microwave oven. Yeah, we talked about that a long time ago, but I was going to do that actually on air here.
Okay, as long as it's not the kind of thing that, you know, people are going to do and...
Oh, yeah, no, I don't advocate this. I tried it once. And
yeah,
it was a mess.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all Bob Wright needs is you doing some wacky experiment, and all our dozens of viewers try to repeat it, and leads to a class action lawsuit.
You've got to say, don't do this at home. Don't try this under any circumstances.
Yeah, definitely.
We don't want to have liability problems for Bob.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about that, George. That's I think the viewers of Blogging Heads, after all this you know, talk about invisible beings and, you know, all that bullshit, want to get back to lightning bolts. They want to get back to hardcore science.
Yeah.
The
mysteries
of nature.
Well, I think I'll have to get someone on the show to give the opposite point of view, that lightning bolts are being, you know, hurled down by the god Thor, or being caused by the Christian god to punish us for our sins and things like that, because, you know, you have to, you know, teach the controversy.
Sadly, I think you probably wouldn't have too hard a time finding such a person, especially in Santa Fe.
Well, yeah, that's true. Boy, there's this wacky show that it's on what's an otherwise really great radio station that calls itself Radio Free Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
But on Sunday morning, I imagine it's to fulfill their public service, you know, obligations for their FCC license, they put on just this ridiculous New Age talk show. And I was listening to it Sunday morning while I was driving, and some woman was talking about, if I remember right, I don't know if it was Carillion photography or some means in which her aura had been photographed, and she was really alarmed because she saw, when she saw the picture, that there was a hole in her aura. And then she realized the hole was caused by the fact that she left her cell phone turned on in her pocket. And this had messed up her aura. And then the guy who's interviewing her says, oh, yeah, wow, I guess that kind of relates into this whole thing about, you know, these cell phones and how they're, you know, frying our brains and things. And all this stuff is talked about, you know, in complete earnestness without any sense that, you know, or anyone challenging it is just complete nonsense.
Mm-hmm. They need to have you on, George. You should work out a contract.
Yeah,
you can be the mean old curmudgeon coming in and you know, making them feel bad about all their wacky beliefs.
Yeah, it's just not my way.
Well, you can come on here and do it then from afar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, preach to the converted.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, we're a minute or 5 minutes past
right.
The hour.
Yeah, better not waste any more electrons.
Well, it's been a pleasure as always, George.
John, you too. I'll look forward to doing this again soon.
Yeah, and I want to hear more about that lightning story, okay?
Okay.
All right, take it easy.